Howdy, y'all. Welcome back to The Stoop. I am Cutter Gonzalez, your host. Today, we are joined by someone very, very special and someone I get the privilege to work with a lot, Felicity Maxwell. Felicity is local here in Austin, where I'm based out of too, and has been a leader in the charge to transform Austin's housing and transit policies to make a future for the city that is more abundant, more accessible, and presents greater opportunities for people of all backgrounds. It's something that has been a long, long overdue project here in Austin, and it's definitely something that Felicity knows well. Austin, like a lot of cities, has a really tough background when it comes to how the city was planned, how growth was managed, and the way power was exercised to shape the city that we know today. Its history is marked by racial exclusion in a very extreme degree. The city we know today as this vibrant, active, growing place is predicated on that history of racial exclusion. And the work of contemporary leaders in Austin is not just to build more homes, but the work is to make an Austin that finally works for everyone. And it's a deeply imperfect process. It's a process that involves negotiations between a lot of different values. And it's a process that I firmly believe, and I think Felicity shares this, is not achievable by taking a no growth, no change attitude. The status quo in Austin is one rooted in a history of exclusion. And the future that people like Felicity are trying to build in Austin is one of abundance and openness and invitation, true to Austin's sometimes unearned reputation. I say that as an Austinite. I love this city. I chose to live here. And it's people like Felicity and their work who give me hope about the future here. So here's a little bit of background about Felicity. Felicity is a small business owner, a housing leader, and a transit activist. She currently serves as a City of Austin Planning Commissioner and was co-mayor of Yimby Town, Austin in February of 2024. She is a board member of Friends of Zilker Neighborhood Association and involved in several Austin ISD leadership committees. With a background in communications and public policy, she has worked as a marketing director for a United Nations-affiliated NGO, as well as for various nonprofits in New York and Texas. She graduated from Vanderbilt University and has a dual master's in public policy from the LBJ School of Public Affairs and an MA in communications from the College of Communication, both at the University of Texas at Austin. I am so glad to have Felicity here, partly because Austin's reputation as an emerging leader in the kind of urbanist, YIMBY pro-housing space is one that's really hard earned and relatively new. And Felicity has been on the ground making that change happen. So without further ado, let's jump in. Hey, Felicity. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how are you? Good to see you.
I'm so good. It's so good to see you. I think, are we both in Austin right now?
We are. And finally, the weather's cooling off a little bit, I think. Maybe.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it's so funny to meet over, to meet virtually, despite being in the same city. But that's how this kind of thing works. But yeah, the weather is so good. I biked this morning and took the train, and it was just amazing. So yeah, I mean, so grateful to have you on. I know a lot about your work just because I'm here and I'm an activist in the same scene you're operating in, which is super cool. But so much exciting stuff that we can share with others in the network. But before we get to all that good stuff and all the big, big wins, I would love to take it back down just to you and to hear about your housing story. Like, what made you curious and excited and passionate about housing, of all things? Because it's kind of nerdy.
Yes. And yeah, it's funny because I actually love this type of question because people are like, how did you get red-pilled or black-pilled or blue-pilled? And I always like to say I blame Brooklyn. Right after I finished grad school here in Austin, I actually moved to Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which is actually pretty similar to Austin in a lot of ways. It's got that great creative vibe, full of smaller brownstone type buildings. And when we moved there, it was actually kind of a real up and coming place. Just felt amazing to live there. And, New York at the time was, it was shortly after 9/11, and it was really on the rebound. And so we spent 9 great years there living in this amazing kind of up and coming neighborhood, seeing it change before our eyes. And when we came back to Austin, we were like, okay, what's next? And of course I was pregnant. We were having our first, I have two kids. We're having our first, and we were happy to be back in Austin to be closer to family. But it sort of felt like it was really a culture shock. And we ended up staying, living downtown in an apartment. And then when we had our second, we're like, okay, finally, we're going to actually buy a house. And then you sort of have this realization, and I think a lot of families in Austin have had this situation where you love Austin and what it's becoming, but where you might be able to live and what you can afford is not ideal, or certainly pretty suburban. We were lucky enough to live in Zilker, which is a neighborhood my husband had lived in before we moved to New York. And so we knew where we wanted to live, and we were lucky to find a great house. This was before the astronomical rise in pricing here in Austin. And then we were living in this single family neighborhood, and suddenly two kids, and you start to feel like, wait, what did I give up for all this? And I think one of the things we missed the most, honestly, was having transit. And so when you start to talk about how can we get trains in a place like Austin, we realize like, oh, you need density. And so then suddenly you're talking about land use. And here you are, at a zoning meeting, which is often, I think, how these things happen. You want one thing and you go down the, rabbit hole, so to speak. And in our neighborhood, for those who don't know Austin very well, Zilker is close to Zilker Park and Barton Springs, which is one of the gems of the city, honestly. And it's a great neighborhood to live in, but it definitely had a very preservationist type feel and was really, I think, the people who were, quote unquote, in charge, or certainly making a lot of those land use decisions, or sort of advocating for specific things in their neighborhood, felt like they were a little out of step with people who are moving in and what we might want. And it started over things like, oh, we can't have a bar on South Lamar. And South Lamar, for those who don't know, is a major corridor here in Austin. Like, that's ridiculous. And the same thing, like, we can't have more duplexes or small apartment buildings. And the neighborhood was full of them. And so I think that was the whole thing, as we started to see like the people who were, quote unquote, in charge, we're making decisions that didn't feel right to us as now residents of this neighborhood. So we actually kind of did a radical thing and we started our own neighborhood association. And, if you'd asked me with two small kids, like, this is something you're going to be passionate about, I probably wouldn't, like, maybe not at the top of my list. And, there were years where it was really hard to do both because kids are demanding and you've got a lot of things going on. But I think ultimately we felt like if we didn't raise our voices and say, hey, this isn't okay, we want other things in our neighborhood, and make that clear to other people who live there, both older and newer residents, that was a really missed opportunity. So, yeah, that's basically how I started. And I'm still living in that single family house, but I am glad to say there are now bars on South Lamar.
Yeah, I have probably been to those bars.
I don't have a train. I didn't get a train yet. I didn't get a train yet, but we got at least got some things.
We're getting there. In fact, I live off South Congress, which runs not right off South Congress, but kind of a block away, and that runs parallel to Lamar, for those who aren't from here. And we have the train coming right down our street. So as much as you can brag on Lamar, it's coming to my neighborhood, Felicity. We're winning.
Yeah, let me just say that that was the only loss I felt like, is that we didn't get enough density, and the train is going the right place, because when visitors come to Austin and they get to go right down South Congress on Project Connect, it's going to be magical. But yeah, it's amazing to me, is all these years later, we're still fighting for some really basic things, and my neighborhood has gotten better, but there's so much more to do, and that's I think, yeah, why we're still here talking about this, right?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And there were a couple things you mentioned that I think are really good to draw out of Austin's example, because it was such an extreme case of what people face in other places. So what you identified as like the preservationist kind of feeling in the Zilker neighborhood, I think that's a pretty big hallmark of Austin across the board until very, very recently. And it's still there for sure. And for good, like I'm the type that believes there is a place for preservation, but not at the expense of the people who really live here now, right? Or the people who want to come here too. As someone who's an Austinite, like I want to make sure that people feel they have a home here. Especially like I came from a place that was not very accepting of folks like me who have pink hair and use they them pronouns and are otherwise queer identifying. And Austin to me was a destination because I could come here and be safe. It was a huge part of my coming out, you know? And so like I don't want preservation for an imagined like old Austin, quote unquote, to prevent people from having the opportunities that I had.
to come here. And I did get priced out right after college, and then I came back. Luckily, because of some of the things that are happening now. But that preservation and sometimes conservation thing that we have here with like the springs and some of the legacy advocacy organizations here, those all come to bear on housing. And I'm curious how you view that, the role that those kind of groups and those arguments play, and how we can honor those concerns while still making progress. Because clearly, like we're kind of doing both in Austin. And right now, you see the progress a lot easier than seeing like things staying the same. But really, you walk around here and it feels like Austin. But now I have 1,000 new neighbors. You know, like what? How are we doing that?
Yes, I actually think that Austin is a great example of this. And I feel like in certain places, and I always hate to pick on California, but a lot of us do. We saw sort of what happened in San Francisco and some other places in the Bay Area where they had sort of that huge tech boom, similar to what happened in Austin, and then their rules didn't change, and they're still sort of really leaning into that environmentalist preservationist, keep everything the same museum feel for your cities. And like that just isn't a solution. And I like to joke, but I think it's a kind of a good one, is that, if you think that's the good place, we went to the bad place in Austin. And like that was really the whole problem, was that things got so bad here that we didn't even need to be San Francisco, because we were Austin. Our housing prices, to your point, a lot of people like you got priced out. A lot of UT students got priced out. We started to feel like, even these new tech workers wouldn't be able to afford to stay here and build lives here. And I think, unlike San Francisco or any of those other Bay Area cities, we really started to say this has to change. And I do think that that's exactly what you're saying, is like both how can we embrace that change, but also recognize, hey, we have a long legacy of like being environmentalists, having that crunchy granola feel. So there has to be an Austin spin on this. And I think, that is something we've really tried to think through as a city, and as leaders in the city, both how do we sort of get more density and build more housing, but also make sure that people don't feel like we're losing what is truly Austin. And I think I've been really excited by some of the, I wouldn't say even compromises, I think some of the way we've navigated those kind of different tides. And I will say there's going to be voices, and we know they exist, and they definitely do in Austin and San Francisco, everywhere, who are just automatically no. They don't want to talk about compromise. They think any sort of compromise is sort of a step backwards, or breaking down a trust or setting a new precedent. But the reality is, like, you can't just say no. And so in Austin, I think we really, as someone well put it here, we're trying to get to yes, and yes in a thoughtful way that helps everybody see that there's compromises available.
Yeah, and I think Austin has a, this is not news to you. We've talked about this, and it's a big part of the discussion here, but Austin has a, century and a half of history of really, really deep exclusion, where development codes were weaponized and municipal services were weaponized to make sure people of color and less economic means were excluded from quite a lot of the city. And Austin wasn't always divided along the I-35 line, right? Like, but then around the time I-35 came to be, or just before it was. And I understand, and really, I really, really sympathize with, because I felt, when you get forced out of a place like I was, you feel that pain in a different way for those communities that were excluded from early prosperity in Austin, middle prosperity in Austin, and then now are like development scared for good reason, right? Like they see investment from the powers that be as potentially excluding them and displacing them and whatever else. And I know this was a big conversation about some recent policy change in Austin. And before we get into like what that was, I would love for you to just like walk me through how you think about that, and how pro housing abundance folks in Austin are thinking about that, because I feel like that is constant in our conversations nationwide for good reason, right?
Absolutely. And I think it is, as much as I am sort of, I don't want to say dismissive, but like, there's some people who are just at no, but some people have really legitimate no's. Like, I want to recognize that right away, because we have done some things, not just in Austin, but across the states, where, you know, urban renewal is it should be a dirty word. Like, there were a lot of bad decisions made in the name of urban renewal, and Austin was no different. And I-35 is exactly, as you said, a scar. And you know, I have two kids in school, and like, guess what? It's not just housing, it's schooling too. We just did a bond in Austin that finally addressed, you know, sort of the underinvestment, the critical long-term underinvestment that we had in our public schools in East Austin. And like, I was proud to be part of that work, but holy God, it was 2022. Like, this didn't need to take so long. So I completely agree with you that there is an underlying sort of real concern about how certain areas have been gentrified, people who've been displaced, you know, and all of that is coming to the front now because we are trying to address some of that. But then if you look at what we did in 1984, which is the code, the last time we've updated our land development code successfully, you can see there's so much racist undertones. And to your point, goes back even further than that to the 1928 plan. So like, there's been things that we have done over many years as a city that have really put us in this place. And undoing that damage takes time. And I think it takes acknowledgement. And I think that that's what we really have tried to do. I'm very lucky on the Planning Commission to work with folks who are very much a part of the affordable housing conversation and tenants' rights. And you know, every time they want to say something of, "Hey, this is something we have to look at," or "Have we considered this?" I want to stop and listen, because it's okay for me to say, "Hey, we need more housing," but you can't make housing that displaces communities and causes gentrification and then actually perpetuates the cycle that we've already created. So I think that that's a really important part of this. And as much as I'd like to say we succeed and we're doing all great things in Austin, we know that we failed before. So our success is actually still only mitigating some of the things that we failed at, really.
Yeah, it's hard sometimes to take a break from the feeling of progress and like the glistening skyscrapers, and you're on the boardwalk at the hike and bike, and you're like, this is such a beautiful, stunning place. And to live in the harder parts of our history, I think is one, just really difficult to go there, and two, even harder to take seriously. So that's a huge part of our activism here, I think, is like, how do we do that now? Because it's been so bad for so long. And I feel like in the last, few years, even like really recent, is the first time I've really seen these conversations elevate to the surface in a way that's not just no or not just yes, right? Like there's nuance, which I think Austin's history and policy landscape desperately needed. So you mentioned that you were on the Planning Commission,
Yes.
and you have quite the resume of activism and of being appointed and all this kind of stuff. Like, tell us about that, like, and then how that relates to recent policy changes, which were big, considered big wins for housing in Austin.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's very much all intertwined. As I discussed, we started a neighborhood organization here in Zilker, and then I got involved with Aura, which is our local sort of pro-housing, pro-transit group. They were really originally focused mostly on transit issues, but then again, as we started to talk about land development changes and how we could build more housing and create density for transit, a lot of the Aura focus shifted to sort of those types of issues. And you know, we've been proudly both house pro-housing and pro-transit this whole time. But luckily in 2022, when I mentioned we were all in a bad place here in Austin, we had the opportunity to get some new folks elected to council. And that was really where the sea change came in. And there were a group of us who really spearheaded that effort. And in my own district, we elected a new person. Our previous council member had been termed out. So we elected someone who was much more pro-housing. And I think he appreciated the sort of mindset that we had brought to those elections and wanted to make sure that those voices were now represented on a planning commission, which, to be honest, they had not been. And like, that was the case for many years. Like, we might have one or two people who were like, "Oh, we should build some apartments," but that was not the majority of our planning commission. And I always like to point out that it's great to win elections and it's great to have council members. And when you see your city council like meeting and there's people who have those voices, but guess what? The things that happen on boards and commissions, especially in a place like Austin, are just as critical. So you need to have those voices consistently everywhere, because otherwise they don't feel like the support is there to say, "Oh yeah, we should build that apartment building," because planning commission said we should build it, because our parks committee said we should get more parkland to, because we're going to build that apartment building. So it's an ecosystem that you're really trying to create and reinforce that has this messaging around, if we have housing supply, if we're thoughtful about how we do it, we can really alleviate a lot of the issues we've seen in Austin in terms of housing affordability, access to workforce, jobs, a lot of other things, and really grow our economy and our city in a thoughtful way. So we were trying to really create that moment And thankfully, we had a great election season. And I one of the things that came out of it that I was appointed to planning commission. And let me tell you, it's so much fun, which is the funniest thing you hear because most people are like, "What do you mean you get to review zoning cases?" I'm like, "Have you ever looked at a zoning case?" So yes, I'm well suited to this job because I find it fascinating and I love it. And I've been really blessed to be able to do this work. And as you pointed out, because we had so many voices at City Council and then on the Planning Commission, we were able to do a lot of great work last year with Home One and Home Two, as well as parking reform and numerous other things that we've really managed to do in basically 18 months, which is really stunning. And I think that's why a lot of people know that Austin's on the map for our housing work is because of sort of creating that ecosystem and being given the opportunity to do that work.
Yeah, it's a sea change from where we were when I first lived in Austin. I've had this experience a number of times where I'll be biking, walking, transiting. I'm car free, so you'll never hear me mention being in a car. But where I'm doing these things and I'm complaining about there's some block or two that's disconnected, or there's this other thing that we need this kind of improvement, and then I'm talking to my roommate about it, and we're like, well, let's look it up. And Austin is planning to fix it in the next like 5 months. It's happened like 10 times. And that I've never had that anywhere. Certainly not when I lived in Houston. And we don't even talk about the lack of urbanist scene in New Braunfels, but totally different. You mentioned the home initiative and parking reform. Could you talk about what those are? Because I think it's just incredible.
Yeah, so I'm going to start with parking reform because it came first. And I going back to the elections, one of the things we really actually pushed all the candidates on was we're like, it's time to do parking reform in Austin. And we were lucky because we had done some work in our downtown parking sort of plans. And then as well as near UT, we have a specific overlay there, which is a zoning called University Neighborhood Overlay. And it was basically this incentive program to cut down on the number of parking spots and sort of increased density as a result, and was very successful, as was our work at downtown Austin. And so, like, we had done this little piecemeal work of like, okay, let's talk about parking. And so we had this great coalition, and they also helped us really in the election process of getting people who were excited about changing parking in Austin. And so when we went to these council offices, you know, they're brand new, shiny, like, what do you want to talk about? And we're like, let's talk about parking reform. So we had this push literally from the day they got elected, and then basically 9 months later, we had essentially eliminated parking minimums in the city of Austin, which we're still the largest city that's done that. It's really, I consider it like a signature thing because the will to do it was there on our council because we had done all this pre-work and because they had seen that it hadn't made a huge impact in other parts of the city. And, you know, there was some questions that we had to answer. As good advocates, we had to be ready to explain things. But I mean, I can't think of a situation where the outcome that we were trying to get to, I don't want to say this too loud, but it almost felt like a cakewalk because we had done all the work and like so that we were building on things that were already sort of seen in a really good light and had success. And so when we needed this early out win, it was parking reform, which just ended up being this huge, huge gift. And the reason I always want to talk about parking reform first because it allows us to then to what we call home one and home two. And if you think about a single family lot, there's two issues. How many units can you put on that single family lot if you're going to go beyond one? Because most people think of like duplexes or ADUs. So that was home one. How many units can you put on? And then home two was, what if you want to subdivide the lot? What does that look like? So you have a big lot and you want to keep your little house or you want to build three little houses. What does that look like? So essentially, what we were saying is most of the city of Austin is zoned single family. How can we better use this land to create smaller units that are more affordable, either through adding units to existing lots? And, you know, sort of putting in those additional casitas, duplexes, ADUs, and really loosen up and sort of rethink that whole sort of how you add units to existing lots. Or if you have a lot that you want to do something new with, what does that look like? And in both cases, we ended up with three units up to, and in fact, with Home 2, you can do a little bit more, which is exciting. But Home 1 is really three units by right. And that's an exciting thing because every single family house in the central Austin area is now zoned for that. So if you want to add an ADU, if you want to change the, you know, the sort of footprint of your single family house on your own land, you can do that. And that's really exciting. And then of course, Home 2 exactly takes that a little bit further and allows us to say, okay, if I've got this lot, what can I build here? And in both cases, that was a lot of that was really able to be done because we don't have parking minimums because we didn't have to talk about we have to have a parking space for each one of these houses, or we have to have it didn't matter. Parking minimums have been taken off the table. So therefore, you're just, the world you're opening up is so different because you're saying, okay, we could maybe do 4 if we do a preservation bonus, or we can go up to 16 if the lot is big enough. So like, it just really changed the tenor of the conversation because we'd already done this one critical thing, which is don't think about the cars, think about the housing.
Yeah, that's a huge mindset shift. And I went car-free when I moved to Houston, which sounds crazy to most people.
So brave.
Houston was a surprisingly good place to be car free in my experience. It was the grid was pretty extensive. The worst part was, unsurprisingly, the freeways. Anytime you had to deal with the freeway, it got a little sketchy. But the grid was good enough, and there were some bikeways, like former rail or creek bayous. Sorry, the Bayou Greenways had been enough to where I lived in Montrose and would bike over to Third Ward for school at the University of Houston. And I would take, I could either go up and do Buffalo Bayou for a longer route, or I could go through like Rice and Midtown and then take the Columbia Tap Trail, which is a former rail, up into UH. And that was awesome. But like, I, as someone who's car free, don't need a parking space ever, but I was constantly subsidizing the parking elsewhere, even when I lived in a very urban place. You know, like I live a walking distance to the grocery store, HEB, and I live walking distance to basically to downtown if I want to go on a little bit of a long walk. So I don't need a parking spot. And it was crazy to me that for so long we mandated parking for people like me who didn't need it, you know?
Yeah. But something I think is also important to hear is one of the easy wins I think that a lot of folks can think about getting is eliminate parking minimums for affordable housing. Because let's face it, a lot of folks who are in a lower, so especially the lower income or, you know, more subsidized affordable housing, they're not necessarily going to own a car anyway. It's a huge expense. And if you are on a limited budget, that's probably you're not your first. So to your point, maybe you started doing this as a student and then you transitioned to kind of staying that way. So we know that folks with lower levels of income don't necessarily need or want a car. So then why do affordable housing have to have like one-to-one car? It's ridiculous. And we, same thing, we had done that here in Austin. And, you know, again, some of the people that we work with on Planning Commission were like, I haven't had a car for years. Why am I paying $400 a month for this car spot that I don't need or use? And so I think that exactly that. We had enough activists and sort of anecdotes around the whole idea of being car free is absolutely an option. Some people do it by choice, some do people by necessity. And so like, why are we forcing them to subsidize? And you know, I like to point out that for affordable housing in particular, each one of those surface lots, so like the most basic, you're talking painting the lines in a lot, $10,000 per spot, most cases. So when you say you don't have to have a certain number of parking units, parking spaces for affordable housing, guess what? All of that goes into either building more units or making those units even, you know, sort of better in various ways, in ways that actually impacts these lower income folks. And, you know, maybe that's upgrading the bus stop or, to your point, adding bike storage, things like that, things that actually help them, you know, sort of really benefit from this new housing as well as the transit they already take. So, you know, that's what I think too is like, to your point, unleashing parking, like getting rid of, like when you do the parking stuff, it just opens up this whole world and this definitely different view of how you see housing, which is it's not tied to where the cars go. It's tied to what's there for the person who lives there.
And that's something I was going to add, if you hadn't mentioned it first, is like that Austin wonderfully is not just like, and I think this is part of this new paradigm, right? It's not just like, okay, we get rid of parking mandates, we're done. It's we're getting rid of parking mandates. We're aggressively building our bike network. I mean, really, like pretty much nowhere else I've seen in the United States.
Yeah.
And we're
it's
making
still not
huge,
fast enough.
I know. Yeah, you're preaching to the choir.
We're just
here.
Spoiled here. Sorry.
I know. But and aggressively expanding transit services in ways that are you know, a new e-bike fleet with a really affordable rate for the Cap Metro bike share and a eventual light rail line or two, and new bus rapid transit lanes. And so you have this whole, like you said earlier, kind of this ecosystem that empowers a different kind of lifestyle, one that I think a lot of us would choose, and that also benefits people who end up without a car, if not by choice. So it's not Because that was a thing when I was really struggling. I was a musician, you know, I am a musician, but now I have a job that pays the bills, which I do music
What,
also.
housing advocacy? Wait, what?
Yeah, I know. That's how low the bar was, right?
Yeah.
No, but when I had a car and I was a musician and I was a student, I was like, well, if this thing craps out on me, I'm SOL. I'm up, you know what, creek without a paddle. And that's because I lived in places where we didn't have this. Whereas now, like, even if in fact, my bike got a flat, I didn't fix it for like 3 weeks because I was just using Cap Metro's bike share and it just was like, I'm fine. Those kind of things were such quality of life improvements.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what we like to always say. It's about choice. It's about choice in your transit. It's about choice in your housing. It's about choice to sort of downsize or upsize. Like, I had two kids, I needed a bigger place. I am not going to have two kids eventually. And guess what? I want to downsize. So we need to have that exactly to your point of like this whole suite of choices depending on where you are in your life and what you need that supports your sort of lifestyle. And I think that's what's exciting to me is that, you know, as long ago as it was that I came back here from Brooklyn thinking, oh my God, what have I got myself into? It is now, there's going to be this moment, maybe 15 years from now, where all of that is going to feel like Brooklyn, like, which is just crazy to me. But, you know, that's why I do like to say the advocacy works and the pushing works because guess what? We are building a bike network. We are getting transit. We are adding that density. And, you know, that was a long set of long like years, many years of fruitless, it felt like work, but, you know, it does pay off. And then you know that that's there for your kids and for future generations.
Right.
And it can be improved upon. Like things that we did, the bike lanes that we had 5, 10 years ago felt like, okay, we got a piece of paint on the, woo, this is so exciting. But now, like, we just redid one of our busiest streets in Austin, Barton Springs Road, with a whole Vision Zero treatment. And it's been transformative because it feels much safer to bike. It's really made it much more family friendly. It's improved access to the businesses along there. So we know that that's to your point. Also, we're never done. There's always more work to be done. So, like, you get the housing, you get the transit, and then you say, okay, what do we need to fix? What's next?
Yeah, you mentioned you used the word pre-work earlier when you talked about getting good folks elected to council. I want to know what that pre-work involved because, like I said, I got priced out of Austin in 2019, which you've been here, you know, that's right as things are reaching this kind of fever pitch, and then change started happening, and now we're seeing rents decline, which, like, I never would have imagined a few years ago.
I know.
But here we are, and that's beautiful. So what was that pre-work like? Like, how did you strategize getting these folks to council? Because it feels like the strategy for a lot of it was like, get good people elected and let them run. And that's what's happened.
Yes. And I will say, going back to those dark days of maybe feeling a little bit like you're banging your head against the wall, we tried to rework our land development code here in Austin. And, you know, for any city that's doing that right now, New York City is doing what they're calling City of Yes. It's a process. And the process can get really bogged down in a lot of different ways. And we got bogged down twice, not once, but twice. And then we had a lawsuit. So, like, it just felt like it was this, I mean, probably 7-year saga of like trying to figure out how we could get some better things out of our land development code, which, as we talked about earlier, was from 1984 and based on some really terrible stuff from like the 1920s. So, like, we had a horrific land development code and it's still really not fixed. But I think the thing is, because we had that long set of failures and there was so much resistance and so much of that no and an unwillingness to compromise in many cases, and then the lawsuit on top of it, I think when we came into sort of that 2022, 2020 cycle, it was like, okay, things have got to change. And I will say, interesting how things get sequenced. When a lot of folks, I remember we had a pandemic, but a lot of folks may not remember, but there were transit projects that were actually on the ballot kind of across the United States in 2020. And several cities decided not to do that. They pulled them down because essentially, or delayed them because basically there was this feeling of everyone's stuck at home. Nobody's using transit right now. Like, we're cutting service. And, you know, so like, no, we're not going forward with this. And I want to say, I think that the city of Austin took a really brave stand, which was like, this is when we're doing it. We've already waited too long to do Project Connect. We're going to take this leap and say, we know the voters will support it. And sure enough, we did 60%. So, like, that was kind of this moment of, okay, people want transit. And then the thing became, okay, people want housing. And so, when we came into the 22 elections, I had worked on the transit, the Project Connect proposition. And so, we had this good sense of the people who support this, who support things like transit and opportunities and new options for them to get around the city and new housing options. They were there. We knew they were. There were 60% of Austinites who wanted this type of thing. So to your point, the pre-work is also, you find it in different places. And you know, interesting, like the same sort of thing with, you think about things like a school bond. You see that a school bond, or even we had done a parks bond, a bikeways bond. So you see people who want to support change in your city, and then you say to them, "Hey, here's a change agent. Here's a person who's going to help you know, make sure that new school bond is used properly. Is going to make sure that the new bike paths come through your neighborhood and are nice and wide and safe for your kids." And like, so that's what we started to see, was that not only are you saying, "Hey, these are things we value as a city, and we're going to put the money behind it," but here's the people who can help do the best job with that money and make it really successful. And that's what we got in 2022. We got several new council members. We reelected some great council members, and suddenly it was like, "All right, let's go." And you know, that's, you know that moment in the Avengers where everyone shows up, right? Like, that is exactly how it felt here in Austin. It was like, "Okay, we're done with the dark days." And I think that's why I think parking reform is instructive, is we were literally ready to hit the ground running, as were the people who we elected, and we wanted them to be seen as doers, and they have been, which has been tremendous.
It does feel so categorically different from how it used to. And I think this is one of the more interesting eccentricities of our pro-abundance council members, but we have one who was not always that way,
No.
right? And
Such a good story.
her name is Leslie Poole, and it was her office that initiated some of the home reforms, right?
It was. And you know, it's so interesting to hear the backstory on this, because essentially a lot of these new, and we'll call them young guns, because they were, I think that is actually important to note, is that we got a lot of fresh faces who were younger and closerly, more closely tied to the sort of affordability crisis. One of our new council members who represents the University of Texas area, he was a renter when he got elected, and that's Council Member Qadri, and he led on parking reform because he knew how expensive parking was, like, and unnecessarily expensive. So anyway, point being is that she was seeing these other sort of folks come in and make these waves and do all this work, and I will say, get sort of attention and kudos for that and support. And Leslie had been reelected. She was at the end of her, and for those who don't know, Austin changed our sort of council setup. We went to a 10-1 system. So we have 10 districts plus the mayor. And Leslie had been elected when, or Council Member Poole, I should say, was elected when we started that process. So she had been served, she'd served for a long time, and always felt, I think, a little bit like out of place, because while she had always often voted with sort of those protectionist and sort of preservationist type voices, when those new folks showed up on the dais, she was suddenly like, "Hey, wait a second, I can change my mind about things." And so it is delightful to see that exact thing happen, because I think people don't recognize too, when you do get new voices elected to something like the city council or a planning commission, it helps to change the conversation. It helps other people to see things in a different way. And if you are good at your job as an elected official or a planning commissioner or someone who's whatever board or commission you happen to serve on, or even as an advocate, you are changing minds and hearts. And so when you have those conversations and say, "Hey, everything's kind of unaffordable. Do you want to do something about that?" And Councilmember Poole's office was like, "Well, yes, we do." So they jumped right in the middle. And I actually think there could not have been a better council member to bring this, the Home One and Home Two ordinances, because essentially she had so much trust from the community because she'd been there since the beginning. She had often supported specific things that protected Austin's environmental sort of, I would say, milieu, like the thing we cared about the most. She often was right there at the front saying, like, "Hey, we have to think about our streams and our parks and green spaces and everything else." So for her to then say, like, "Look, we're not using our land the best way we can, and we need to make some of these reforms," everyone was like, "Oh, okay." And like, that's the thing, is her shifted a lot of other people. So I think that's the other thing, is it becomes this domino, to your point, of like, yeah, mind shift, and then you kind of create this ecosystem where everyone can start saying yes, and everyone can start figuring out what's the way we can do this that feels balanced. And that's, I think, how Home was so successful, was we had people who had never really taken that leap of faith before saying, "Hey, let's look at this, and maybe we can figure out something that works." And I want to give Councilmember Poole's office a lot of credit for being brave and doing that work, and also the coalition that she built, because she had a different perspective than, say, some of those young gun urbanists who walked in January being like, "What are we going to do?" Right? So yeah, I think it's a really instructive piece of, not only do you win the elections, but when you win the elections, it changes the tenor of the conversation. And so use that. Don't be afraid to work with people who you maybe never would have thought you were going to work with, because it leads to places you can only imagine.
When I saw Councilmember Poole initiating these conversations, again, for having been priced out pre-pandemic, I was like, hold on, am I misremembering?
It's a little bit of shock.
I just think it deserves the utmost kudos to be vulnerable and brave enough as an elected official where your reputation is on the line to change. Like that is just, you don't see that, right? Like we see the opposite. You see
No,
people
and
dig in.
I want to, yes, dig in. And I also want to give full credit to our mayor, our current mayor, who I think had a little bit of the same change of heart, because when he got elected, we'll call it a squeaker because it was a squeaker. He, there was, it was a very close election, and he came in, and he wasn't necessarily the biggest pro-housing choice. I mean, in fact, most of people supported his opponent because we she came she ran on a very pro-housing platform. But when he came into office, I think he took a look around and was like, oh, I'm the one who's out of step here. It's not me. Right? Like, and kudos to him, because he had been mayor before and he'd gotten a lot of stuff done is as a mayor, and really wanted to be that action-oriented person again, or bigger, when he came back to Austin as a mayor. And here he was suddenly realizing, oh, the action now is around addressing housing, looking at our land development code, fixing things that have made Austin impossibly unaffordable. And he talks about this thing called intergenerational affordability, which I think is such a great way of thinking of it, because he's older and he knows, like, he's going to finish this term. If he gets reelected, he's going to have another 4 years, and that's probably it. He is not likely to have another big job, certainly not in Austin. And he wants to make sure that when he walks away from being the mayor of Austin twice, the thing people remember is that he made it affordable for people to come and stay and build their lives here. Because he said, I was given that opportunity many, many years ago, and look what it's given me. So for me to say that I won't want that for other people, that's inequity. And like, that's not the type of people we are in Austin. And like, what leadership is that to say, I may not love the idea of density or more people or every, like, I have concerns, but the thing I know in my heart is that I want Austin to be as welcoming, if not more, than it was when I came here, and have that same opportunity for other people. So, like, another great message for people to hear and take in and say, oh, okay, maybe I can get behind this housing thing, right?
Yeah, just, I mean, extraordinary examples of leadership, courage, and probably in the face of for folks of long-standing relationships to the advocacy communities here, real risk, like to say, I'm gonna go a new way. And I hugely respect all of that. I think that's critical. One of the things you said that like this is something I think about day in and day out, doing communication strategy and just thinking about the movement we're building around housing abundance nationwide, is you said the kind of people we are in Austin, which I think brings up feelings of like identity formation. Like, what is it like to be an advocate in, or to be an Austinite, period? And I live by this mantra that behavior is downstream of identity. And if you've worked with me at the Welcoming Neighbors Network, you've probably heard that 10 times, and I'm sorry, but it is a recent big learning for me, and I think it's huge. I think part of the work that you've done, Felicity, and that the advocacy community in Austin has done is reconstituted what it means to be an Austinite, pulling from the best. Like taking the desirable things, even if some of them were more reputation than reality at times, right? Taking those,
I'm sorry, live music capital of the world, come on.
right. Well, or even just like the hippie tolerant lefty kind of thing, while we were like, please, black and brown people go over there, you know? Like that was like, how can we have both those things? And this current moment is one of like, we couldn't. But there was a good part of this that was more myth than reality that doesn't have to be more myth than reality. And it feels to me like we're reconstituting what it means to be an Austinite in a way that is more inclusive, more equitable, more solutions focused, while taking all of our early and really good commitments to environmental stewardship, to thinking ecologically, to being inclusive and relaxed, and a little more laissez-faire attitude about our culture here. And bringing those into the future in a way that is respectful of the past, but generative and alive, which I think so many cities like languish in this kind of like conservative, conservationist, preservationist, whatever words you want to use. And we don't do that here. It would feel weird if you were an Austinite, and not good weird, not keep Austin weird. It would feel weird
No.
if you were here and you were just really anti anything new. I'd be like, well, that's not what we do.
What? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. And it's so funny because my husband's name is Austin, and he remembers when, like, the most excited, like, I can't, folks who are Matt's El Rancho, which is in South Austin, was like the big place you went for your birthday. And, like, you know, he has remembers, like, and but that was like considered the sticks. And I mean, like, so that's the city of the Austin or the city now. So I think that's the thing, is that we know Austin has changed, and it went from being a really sleepy university and capital town to this kind of thriving, and we've done a lot of things right. Like, we have a Formula One race, which may not be for everybody, but it certainly puts you on the map. Same thing, we have an MLS team, and like, we have a university that's, you know, world renowned. And so, like, the city was already changing. And so, to your point, it's like, you can't say that Austin is going to stay the same. Like, that's just not realistic. That's not what's, and I think that's true for so many cities. Cities are meant to be dynamic. They're meant to be different. And I was lucky to live in Brooklyn and Williamsburg at a time when it was changing. It has a long history of being a sort of Italian and Jewish enclave, and like, very much an immigrant focus. And then all these young white hipsters showed up, and believe me, that's a different kind of gentrification. I mean, it is gentrification. And so, like, we saw that struggle happening when we lived there, and we were part of that. And so I think that's the thing you have to say to yourself, is there is no showcase, there is no amber you can freeze a city in. And if you do, you're doing a disservice to everybody who lives there and what the city can become. And there are people who don't necessarily love where Austin is going, or some of the things that we now consider more acceptable. But if you look around and you see the people who live here now, I don't think there's anybody who thinks that we're like worse off, or that, you know, we're going backwards. And if you do have those opinions, you're probably not living in the right place. Because to your point, we've tried to really shift this narrative of Austin is dynamic and awesome. We want you to come here. We have these opportunities in tech, in UT, in state government, across the board, in biotech, and all these new places. And so we're creating this world, this community that is of doers and thinkers and innovators. And if you have that as your kind of mantra and the way you think of yourself as an Austinite, you have to have policies that back that up. And so that's what I think. Yeah, it's we've shifted, I think, a little bit as a city and how we think of ourselves as Austinite. And I hope that we can hold on to that, because I want to see 100 years from now, if we're this dynamic now, like, well, you know, we'll be blowing the lid off the place. So
Yeah.
yeah, it's exciting.
There's a kind of certain brand of Austin activists, and I won't say if I am part of this or not. People can judge on Twitter, but that like will propagandize Austin like obviously over the top, but I'm like, we're speaking it into reality. I'm like, New York City, Chicago,
Yes.
LA, Austin. Like
Oh,
we're up there. Paris,
yes.
who? You know, like I love it. I think that imagination is really beautiful and creative, and at this in this kind of new era that we're inaugurating, because we're very much at the beginning of this work, it is something we're creating in a way that is more oriented toward justice and belonging than ever before. And
Yeah, I think your point is so well taken about that too, is because we do are trying to really take the best parts of Austin. And I will say that the work is on that particular side is never done, because you know, we even think about some of the zoning reforms and things we've gotten to change in Austin. There are parts of West Austin that are still very much wealthy white enclaves that are very protected with the best schools. And like, that's a generational shift. That's a long-term change. And so, and we know that those folks still have a lot of sway and power, even in City Hall and other places. And so, you know, you,
courthouses.
and of course we should, yeah, stay, I was gonna say, and then State House, like, the work is ongoing, and we can be excited about how we're trying to shift this narrative. But yeah, to your point, the narrative has to be different too, about some things that we overlooked for a long time, or certainly gave a blind eye. Because if that isn't more inclusive or more justice focused, then we're not any better than the folks and the ideas that they had 40 years ago.
Right. And that is hard work to do. It has been hard work
Yes.
for communities that have been excluded. And it's hard work for those who have benefited from exclusion and have come to realize that and not get into kind of cynical doom loop NIMBYism. And that is the thread that feels like we're trying to pull right here in Austin, and it's I think it's an opportunity to be a leader on how to do that. And I know that you're centering that in your conversations on the Planning Commission. We've talked about it over beers, all kinds of stuff.
Absolutely.
It's so important. And I hope that Austin's future is one of abundance, finally, for everyone. And I know that we're trying to build that at the city level, and I hope that the state doesn't come in and try to squash all those efforts.
And I will actually say, I think that's the most interesting thing to me about Austin and what we've accomplished is, I'm so happy we're a leader, and I'm so happy, like, literally, as we are doing this work week in and week out at city council and, planning commission and whatnot. But the biggest thing people take away from this is that we're a model, and, like, please learn from us, take our lessons and try to replicate it. And the way you do it may not be the way we did it, but maybe it gives you inspiration, maybe it gives you hope, maybe it gives you ideas of things you haven't thought of doing before. Because if we're the only shiny new city on the hill, then what's the point? We need shiny new cities on the hill across the United States, because it can't just be about choice in Austin. It has to be about choice across the United States and across the world. That's why we are pro housing and pro transit, because that gives people opportunities to live really rich, different lives. And it shouldn't just be an Austin thing. It should be, oh, Austin did it, we can do it too. And here's how they did it, and maybe this is how what we should try. So that's what I really hope people take away from this.
Yeah, and I think the Austin case study, with its interesting environmentalist, racial class dynamics, the confluence of a university and state government, and the kind of mindsets that have thrived or been excluded here, can give us lots of examples for other places who can pull different parts of that and learn from the advocacy. Last thing I want to ask you, because I know we're butting up on the time here, is, what's next? What's coming up?
Oh, I'm so excited. I have so many good things, but the one thing I will really just put a plug in is for single stair reform. And this is a kind of a point access buildings is another name for it. I think the best thing we've really come up with is corridor elimination buildings, because essentially what we're doing is getting rid of those big long hallways and trying to use the footprint where we build smaller apartment buildings in more efficient ways. And everyone talks about how if you go to Paris, you see these single access, and they literally have one staircase and maybe two or three apartments off of each on each landing. And that's what we're trying to really legalize here in Austin. And this is just another great example of where we have found ourselves at the sort of forefront of this conversation. And this is actually not a zoning conversation; it's what we call technical building codes. And I have gotten way too much in the weeds in this, so I will not go down that road with y'all. We can do a whole separate, that's going to be our next podcast, is single stair reform across the United States. But really, it's been fascinating to work with national leaders, folks in Seattle and other places that already have some version of this, and really try to say, again, this exact thing we've been talking about. How do we do an Austin version of this? And how do we do an Austin version of this that then can be used as a model for other places? And the really interesting thing to me is that when Austin folks walk into a room and start to ask about single stair, which just happened at a symposium, and they talk about what we've experienced with affordability and why we think that this type of infill development is really important, people listen because they know that we're trying to address our housing crisis, and they're trying to do it in really interesting and innovative ways. And like put in like I, you know, if you think about that Jenga tower, instead of pulling the bricks out, we're putting the things back in. So like, let's legalize three lots. Let's legalize single stair buildings. So that's the most exciting thing to me, because it does really fit in with the work we've already done. It's a really interesting concept that's very well understood in other parts of the world, and we're trying to bring it here to the United States. And if we manage to get this passed, it'll once again show like how you can work as a advocacy community with, local leaders as well as sort of stakeholders in the city to build something that feels right for your city and also permits more housing. So yeah, I could talk about that one for a long time. I'm really excited. And then I will just mention we have elections coming up, and we're hoping for some great results there too. So busy fall, busy spring, and we're just going to hope to be able to keep doing this work.
Yeah, the single stair stuff is a constant branding comms dilemma, where it's like, what does that actually mean? And like the corridor elimination thing, I think probably many of the listeners have been in like buildings with those long internal corridors that look almost like hotels, but somehow more liminal. And that they don't
Worse.
need,
Hotels are
they don't
nicer.
need to be that way.
They don't
Right.
go anywhere. They don't come with room service.
Right. And that's all part of like technical building specifications that have resulted in that form, and that there's an alternative possible that is still safe and is more like what I think a lot of us would prefer when it comes to, quote, density. Is like, I want to live proximal to my neighbors, but I don't want to have to walk past 20 gray doors to find my, one door that I can recognize only by a number,
Yeah, and they were actually joking that they call these like romance buildings, because you get to know the people on your floor or the person who lives below you, or because it's a much smaller footprint, like maybe 20 units. So suddenly the idea that you have to don't swipe on the phone, go downstairs and offer your neighbor a cup of sugar, right? So, like I think that's the thing is it is also to your point about building a better urban fabric that goes along with some of the other things we've already talked about. And, encouraging family size units so that people like me don't have to move out to the suburbs or wherever it may be. And fight for bars in their neighborhood because that's the thing is then you're living in a building that's next door to the bar, and you and your new neighbor who you just met over the cup of sugar can go enjoy a glass of rosé and pretend you live in Paris, but you don't have to because it's Austin, Texas.
I will say, I live in a small apartment complex that is kind of the equivalent of a single stair size for each of the three small buildings, but the stairwells are external. And I have never known my neighbors better than this. And we did just that thing. We went over, we were, my roommate and I were hanging out with some of my neighbors, and we went over to Kelly's Irish Pub and had a few beers. And it was such a like, wow. This is what life can be
Yeah,
like. You know, this is the
be
dream.
like.
Like, we have friends, and like, when I needed my cats to be out of the house for a pest treatment, I could like give them to a neighbor. The neighbor was like, oh, don't worry, get them whenever. It's like
Yeah.
crazy how that proximity helps us so much. It fills up life in beautiful ways. But that's exciting. You'll see me at City Hall. You know I'll be
Yes.
there.
Okay, good. We have t-shirts.
Oh, good. Actually, I think I have one of the t-shirts.
Yes,
Because I was at
exactly.
the first planning hearing, but
Yes, you have to help us with the branding.
I'm here for it. You just give me a call anytime. But anyway, since we're running out of time, I just wanted to say so much that I'm grateful for your time, for your work in Austin as an Austinite. I benefit from your work and expertise immensely, and I'm grateful for you sharing these stories with the Welcoming Neighbors Network community. I think it's really important. So thank you.
Well, and yes, I really appreciate the time to share all this. And I'm really grateful for the folks involved in Welcome Neighbors Network because, just the fact that there's people who want to listen to a podcast like this and hear from us and take those stories back to work they're doing locally and for us to see their results, it is nice. It's sort of like a single stair building, except for co-housing folks, right? We're all getting to know each other and support each other. So, yeah, this is great. And I hope that, yeah, so glad to be a part of this podcast, and I hope lots of lessons learned and that it'll be just as successful for you guys.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Felicity. We'll talk soon.
All right, thanks. Bye.
I hope y'all enjoyed this conversation with Felicity as much as I did. She is just so fun to talk to and knows so much about the work. And she takes the hard questions of this work very, very seriously and is very honest about ways that her work and the city of Austin has failed on its promises before. It's rare to find someone who can so honestly say, yeah, we screwed up, and then stick to the work and try something a different way. And I think that's just really courageous and requires a lot of vulnerability and is worthy of so much respect. I hope that the lessons from here on the ground in Austin can be carried into your work and that this was a meaningful hour spent together. Thanks so much for listening. You can find Felicity on Twitter at CityJane. That's CityJane. And you can follow the changemakers who are fighting for an abundant Austin for everyone over at Twitter at AuraATX. That's AuraATX. Be sure to follow the Welcoming Neighbors Network on all your favorite social media channels at WNN Pro Housing. We share the work to build abundant communities across the entire country on these channels. And of course, we love seeing all of the hot urbanist takes that y'all share as well. This show is produced in-house at the Welcoming Neighbors Network by me, Cutter Gonzalez, and the music was composed by my good friend, Nolan Hopkins. I am so grateful for your listenership and to work with this wonderful community of creatives in achieving an abundant future for everyone. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll talk again soon.